Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 11 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
Good morning, Dr. Richard.
Good morning.
You hear my voice?
What about this voice this morning?
I'm channeling my best Barry White. I'm struggling with some allergies, so it gives me a nice baritone.
He sings at the Holiday Inn at night.
Well, I'm going to work through it, though, because I'm very excited about our topic today. Over the past, well, since we've started the podcast, we've kind of been going through an evolution through a number of issues, primarily focused on education, which primarily has us focused on children and adolescents. Right. And today we're going to continue that evolution, and we're going to leave some of the testing stuff behind for at least for now. And we're going to get into some of the other consequences of what's related to what's going on in the school system. And that is, we're going to focus a lot today on ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Now, why I'm relating that to education will be revealed later on. But in the meantime, we're going to work through and talk with you about what ADHD is, the difference between ADHD, the actual disorder, and ADHD symptoms. We're going to talk to you a lot about how this disorder has evolved over time and how we got to where we are today, where it seems like just about everybody has the disorder. I was diagnosed with ADHD as a child. I never received treatment until I was in graduate school. But lots of other people, of course, are diagnosed with ADHD, both in childhood as well as in adulthood. So we're going to kind of go through that, where ADHD came from, and again, how we got to where we are now. So
I didn't know that your ADHD was officially diagnosed. You have a formal diagnosis.
Well, yeah.
I thought I was the only one who knew.
No, it was, we knew that I had ADHD from early on, and my parents chose not to have me medicated. But something, again, that we'll get to that'll be different is that my teachers, when I was a child, managed it very differently than teachers do today. Mm-hmm. For example, I remember it was first or second grade. I had a wonderful teacher. And after lunch, my symptoms really began to increase at that time. And so every day after lunch, she would send me outside to run around the building a few times. She just gave me that opportunity to work off some of that energy, and that helped me get through the rest of the school day. She certainly didn't punish me or give me office referrals or anything like that. She was very forward-thinking and sent me outside to run around a little bit, and I could come back in and do my math work and do my reading. So, but today we don't do that. And so we're gonna talk about how ADHD has this explosion. And we're going to refer to a book called The ADHD Explosion that was written by Dr. Henshaw and Scheffler, and talk about that a little bit, because they present some fantastic information in that textbook as it relates to where ADHD is today. This will likely, Richard, I think we were talking about it earlier, this is likely going to spill over into two or three podcasts, because there's so much to talk about ADHD. You know, we use the term so loosely today for any child who doesn't sit still, for any child who isn't immediately obedient. We use this term, oh, he has ADHD, in a very almost flippant way. I mean, it's just, oh, he just has ADHD. So we're going to talk about that and hopefully give you guys a little bit more awareness about what the disorder actually is and what we can do about it. That sound okay with you?
Sounds good. Yeah, I think it's going to be at least two, maybe three sessions. We'll see how it goes. And again, we'd love to hear from you guys. Let us know if there are issues that you want us to talk about or go into in more detail. Love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely write to us either on our Facebook page at The Mental Breakdown on Facebook, or you can check out our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. We would certainly love for you to write opinions or reviews on iTunes, because that always helps let more people know that the podcast is here and that this information is available. You can email us. You can follow us on Twitter. At Dr. Bernie is the Twitter account. So, yeah, get in touch with us. Let us know your stories about ADHD, either for yourself or for your child or for somebody else that you know. Let us know what you've experienced. So that'd be great. Good idea. All right. Well, Dr. Richards, let's start out with a history lesson. And I always look to you for the history lessons because you love history.
Oh, okay.
That was one of the first things that I learned about you when we first met all those years ago, is that you are a student of history. And I always like hearing how you describe the evolution of things through history. So talk to us about how ADHD began and where we are now.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things I like about looking at things historically is where these things come from, and are they new? ADHD, most people think ADHD is a relatively recent thing, or it's a phenomenon of modern culture, you know, video games and TV and all that. Actually, there are descriptions of children with these symptoms of hyperactivity and poor impulse control and inattention that have been with us for hundreds of years. And in fact, one of the first articles was written by an English physician, written in 1798, in which he describes all of the symptoms that we now associate with ADHD. In 1865, there's a famous story written, and the title of it is Fidgety Phil, and you can imagine what the topic of that was. It was a little schoolboy, and he was described as Fidgety Phil.
That would be a great comic book character.
I thought about that. That would be a good one to follow.
Fidgety Phil.
Somebody ought to pick up on Fidgety Phil. And then in 1902, George Still, again, English physician, was able to describe English school children that he saw who had the disorder. So certainly it's not a new disorder. But one of the things that brought the disorder to the forefront was the encephalitis epidemic of 1917 and 1918. Right at the end of World War I, there was a worldwide flu epidemic. I can remember my great-grandmother was sort of a medicine woman in her village. You know, they lived in this little village in Pennsylvania, and she helped treat people with that flu. It was a deadly flu, resulting in a lot of deaths. A lot of people died from that, especially children and the elderly.
Well, let's mention real quick about what encephalopathy is.
Okay.
Because we kind of hear that word sometimes, and it sounds like a very specific disorder or condition or disease or something. But really, it's a little bit more general than that, right?
Right. Encephalitis is an inflammation, ITIS. When you attach it to appendicitis, that's an inflammation of the appendix. Dermatitis, inflammation of the skin. Encephalitis is an inflammation of the encephalocele. Encephalocele is the word for the brain. So the pandemic of 1917 and 1918, which was a disorder that affected the brain in particular. Encephalitis is an inflammation of the brain. And the survivors, if you got that flu and you survived it, some of the symptoms were impaired attention, impaired memory, and a loss of impulse control. So suddenly in 1917 and 1918, we have medical evidence that the same symptoms that we see in youngsters with ADHD, what we call ADHD, also appear in people who have had this flu that affected their brains. And so this is the first connection that we have of maybe these ADHD symptoms are the result of some underlying brain abnormality. And right. That's the importance of that 1917, 1918 flu epidemic, is that it was the first indication that the symptoms of ADHD might have a basis in the biology of the brain.
And that's how we got the first name for the disorder.
Exactly.
Which is minimal brain dysfunction.
Right, right. Because the other thing that happened was there were two German, one was a psychologist, one was a physician, who came to the United States to flee Nazi Germany in the late 30s. Their names were Werner and Strauss, and they went and worked at a state hospital in near Detroit at Wayne State. And so they came here to escape Nazi persecution. Their job in Germany, before they left Germany, what they did is they were treating German soldiers who had suffered head injuries during World War I. Mm-hmm. And when they came to the United States and they began working with these mainly boys who were institutionalized, they were struck by the similarities in symptoms between these boys who had been placed in this institution and the brain-injured soldiers from World War I. So at about the same time that we have the encephalitis, the flu epidemic of 1918, a few years later, a couple decades later, we have these German physicians who are saying, yeah, the symptoms look very similar to the brain-injured soldiers from World War I. So again, we have mounting evidence by the 1940s and 50s of some brain connection. And so what Werner and Strauss did is they took these kids who had normal intellectual abilities. They were normal in every other way, but they had all these symptoms, and they also had trouble learning. So they had the symptoms of ADHD, and they also had learning problems, despite the fact that they had what looked like average intellectual abilities. And so because there was no documented brain damage, they began using the word minimal brain damage. That was in the 1940s, so 1947, 1948. They called it minimal brain damage. Well, that was still, many people felt like that was overstating the case. So they changed the name in the 1950s to minimal brain dysfunction to get away from the, we really can't document that there's brain damage. So we'll call it minimal brain dysfunction.
Because again, at that time, how did we know what the brain looked like?
Right.
We could only see it by autopsy.
The only way, all these new technologies, the CT scan didn't appear until 1968. And so we had no way of examining the brain, or very few ways of examining the brain in a live person. We had to wait and do it during autopsy, and autopsy is not a real picture.
And even that was just gross anatomy.
I mean,
it's not gross as in gross as in global
right.
overall. And so we couldn't see what was happening on the molecular level, what was happening mm-hmm. on the chemical level. And so when we think about it that way, it's really amazing that these physicians were able to put some of this stuff together
right.
to say, hey, if we look at these systems, because again, we didn't have the internet then, we didn't have
right.
very quick ways of being able to communicate with one another, so even within the United States.
Right.
So the ability to put these things together and piece these pieces together is amazing. It's,
right.
it's wonderful that they're able to do that.
Right. Yeah, so by the 1950s, we have this growing body of knowledge that the symptoms that we associate with ADHD, hyperactivity, poor attention span, learning problems, and poor impulse control, seem to have some basis in brain function.
Right.
But that's all we really knew. We didn't know what parts of the brain, we didn't know what the brain was doing, we didn't know the exact connection, but we knew there was some relationship between the symptoms and underlying brain function. And then in the 1960s, we have a very sharp separation.
Yes.
Because in 1952, the American Psychiatric Association publishes the first diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. And this was just a little handbook. It was a spiral-bound handbook that they
right.
used. It had a few diagnoses in
there. Just a handful of diagnoses.
And it wasn't even mentioned in that first book.
ADHD wasn't.
Hyperactivity, impulse control, none of these things were mentioned in the first edition of the DSM. That was in 1952. So by 1952, it's not even recognized as a disorder. This is going to change in the 1960s. In the 1960s, parents were becoming more and more concerned about children, about their own children, who had what we now call learning disabilities. These are kids who have normal intellectual abilities who are unable to learn. And many of these same children also had attentional problems. So, but nobody at that point knew what to do about them. But in 1962, there was a meeting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the term learning disabilities was first used. And so educators began to think of these kids as not having minimal brain damage or minimal brain dysfunction, but they started to use the term learning disabilities. Later on in the 1960s, the American Psychiatric Association, which by now was publishing the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, mentioned this disorder for the first time in 1968, and they call it the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood and adolescence. So, 1962, we have the coining the term learning disabilities. 1968, we have the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood and adolescence. And hyperkinesis is too much movement. So they're keying on the hyperactivity part.
Right. So this is the second name, or actually the third name, second time we've changed the name.
That's right. Minimal brain damage, minimal brain dysfunction. Now we have the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood and adolescence.
Right. All of which are referring to the same behaviors in childhood for the most part.
Right.
Perhaps the etiology is different, how the symptoms were presumed to be caused are different, but the behaviors are relatively the same, though we're changing the name.
Right, right. And then 12 years later, in the 12 years between 1968, when the second edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual came out, and 1980, in that 12-year period, a woman in Canada by the name of Virginia Douglas began to write about what she thought the primary symptom was. And she said, the primary problem here is not hyperactivity or hyperkinesis. The primary problem for kids in school is attention problems. They couldn't focus their attention. It was affecting them in school. And so when the third edition of the manual was published, the name was changed again to attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder without hyperactivity.
Right.
And that was the first time that the concept, the idea that attention as the primary symptom was reflected in the name of the disorder. So by 1980, we have ADDH, attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity, and ADD-NOH without hyperactivity.
Right. So now we're starting to get into what we classically consider to be ADHD.
Right. That was in 1980. Right.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the DSM has gone through several more revisions. There was the DSM-3R, then the DSM-4.
Right.
And now we're into the DSM-5.
Right.
And much of those symptoms, if I remember my history right, much of those symptoms haven't really changed. The diagnostic criteria haven't changed all that much.
Right. The symptoms remain the same. The four primary symptoms of this disorder have remained the same from when it was first described until today. Right. The symptoms remain the same.
So the importance, and now we're going to talk about some of the other minor alterations in the diagnostic criteria and stuff like that in just a few minutes, but it's important that we point out and that we emphasize the fact that it's not new. You know, when you listen to a lot of parenting experts and a lot of people who purport to be experts on childhood and childhood development, you know, they talk about those golden years back in the 1950s where we didn't have these ADHD problems.
Yeah, there was no ADHD back in the 50s.
Right.
Right.
What we see when we actually go back and look at the data is that that is incorrect. Mm-hmm. There absolutely was reports of ADHD as far back as the 1700s.
Right.
So it is not a disorder of not just the 20th or the 21st century. Right. It's not a disorder of the United States.
Right.
It's a disorder that has been around for a long time.
Right. It's worldwide. And in fact, one of the nice ways to think about this, one of the convenient ways to think about it, is that there were children with this disorder running around during the Revolutionary War in our country.
In
the 1700s, late 1700s. So there were children with ADHD in the colonies during the Revolutionary War.
Right. So now, as the DSM-3 was published and then the DSM-4, the criteria that we use for the diagnosis continued to be refined.
Right.
It became more and more specific to include some multiple specific symptoms that we tend to see in children who have ADHD. Difficulty concentrating, avoiding tasks that require concentration, acting as though they're driven by a motor, I think is one of the
right. The
more interesting diagnostic criteria. The impulsivity, the interrupting others, careless mistakes. There's about 18 items that you go through and sort of check off to identify the symptomatic portion of ADHD. Now, that's not enough in and of itself to make a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
To make a diagnosis, you also have to make sure that the symptoms are present in more than one setting.
Right.
And you have to make sure this is something that has evolved with the new edition of the DSM, with the DSM-5, is that the symptoms have to start in childhood. Right. With the DSM-4, they had to begin, there were some impairing symptoms prior to the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've expanded that to where some impairing symptoms have to be present before the age of 12. So they modified that a little bit. And there's no way we're going to get into the topic of adult onset ADHD during this podcast, but I promise that we will talk about that in a future podcast, because that is something that's really important that we talk about. But when it comes to the diagnostic criteria, that's pretty much it. It has to be impairing in more than one setting. Symptoms have to be present before the age of 12, and then we have these 18 items that we go through to differentiate between attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in attentive type, a hyperactive impulsive type, or combined type. Now, I'm mentioning that because one of the things that happen often is people will come into the office and they'll say that their child has ADD. The first time that I mention ADHD, the parent says, oh, no, he doesn't have ADHD, he has ADD.
Right.
And then I want to mention a little bit, very quickly, about where that difference seems to come into play. The DSM is one diagnostic classification system. It's the one that we happen to use in psychiatry. It's the one that because it was published by the American Psychiatric Association, we tend to use that system in psychology as well. But in other areas, and even within psychiatry and psychology, there are other diagnostic systems as well. In medicine as a whole, they tend to use one called the International Classification of Diseases, the ICD. It's up to the 9th or 10th. Well, the 9th edition, the 10th, and even the 11th are coming out pretty soon. But they use the ICD, which is the International Classification of Diseases. There's another one called Birth to 3, which is a diagnostic classification system looking at developmental, behavioral, and emotional difficulties in just children birth to 3. So there's lots of different ones. Well, the two main, the ICD and the DSM, are the ones that are primarily used. So when a patient comes to me and they're being diagnosed, and if I believe that the child meets criteria for ADHD, I will use the DSM and I will say, well, he has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There are three types of ADHD.
Right.
There's ADHD primarily inattentive type, which means that most of the symptoms that the child exhibits are inattention, difficulty concentrating, difficulty focusing on a task, those kinds of things, careless mistakes. But they don't really have the hyperactive impulsive type. So that is what what other people refer to as ADD.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the DSM-5, it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder primarily inattentive type. If a kid comes in and they are hyperactive and impulsive, but they do a relatively good job of focus of attending, and we all know those kids who can, that's sort of how my mom described me when I was a kid. If we went to the movies or something, she said that I would be running up and down the aisles, but on the way home, I could quote the movie. I could give lines from the movie and tell what happened in the movie, because even though I was hyperactive, impulsive, I was still able to focus and pay attention and remember the things that were going on. And so that was ADHD, primarily in hyperactive impulsive type. Now, for those kids who have inattention and hyperactive impulsive, they meet criteria for both of those, then we call those ADHD combined type. All right, so the DSM-5 gives us three subcategories for ADHD. Now, that was a long way to get to. When we diagnose through the ICD, the diagnosis is attention deficit disorder,
ADD,
with or without hyperactivity. So just like what we had with the DSM-3.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and it's not surprising because the ICD-9 came out in the 80s, I think.
That's right. It reflects the nomenclature that was used in the third edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual,
right,
which came out in 1980.
Right.
So because ICD-9 came out at the same time, they have the same names.
Correct.
Okay.
And yes, that means that the ICD hasn't been updated, at least here in the United States. There's other countries that are using ICD-10 already, but we're not using ICD-10 yet.
October?
I think it's October.
Right.
And again, they're already, ICD-11 is already being worked on. So as soon as ICD-10 comes out, some folks are already going to be transitioning soon thereafter to the ICD-11. So we're talking about the same thing. ADD, ADHD, ADD with hyperactivity, it's all the same thing. And then we will just be more specific afterwards, whether it's primarily inattentive type, primarily hyperactive impulsive type, or a combined type. Mm-hmm. But that's how we got where we are. That's how the name has changed over the years. Now, again, we're still talking about pretty much the same behaviors.
Right. We're talking about the same disorder. We're talking about the same behaviors.
Right.
Okay.
Now, also, something else in our history is some interesting things that happened in the 1960s and 1970s. Dr. Richard mentioned the learning disabilities explosion, or the identification, or the first terminology being used as learning disorder. And what happened is, as IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, we talked about that a couple of podcasts ago, as that was coming out, they were looking to see what disorders do we want to include here, and they looked at ADHD, or ADD was what it was called at the time, and they said, you know, because we know that's a brain-based disorder, we're going to leave that one to the medical professionals.
That's right. It was in a medical book. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is published by the American Psychiatric Association. So those are all medical diagnoses.
Right.
So what schools did, what the Department of Education decided was that if there is a medical condition, that we would call it other health impaired.
OHI.
Right. And not include it as a category in special education.
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened with ADHD. And that's why it's not recognized as a disorder in the public school system.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we mention that because, as Dr. Richard said a few moments ago, one of the consequences of ADHD, not the diagnostic criteria, but one of the consequences of ADHD oftentimes is learning difficulties.
Right, right.
Yeah, 60 to 65% of kids with ADHD present as though they have a learning disability. Now, typically, once those kids are receive treatment and their symptoms improve, a lot of those apparent learning difficulties go away. But when the symptoms are active and uncontrolled, then, of course, there's that difficulty with learning and difficulties in the classroom.
Right.
So that's our history. That's how we got to the name that we refer to as ADHD. That's how we got to what we think of diagnostically with ADHD. And that's how you as parents, or anyone out there who thinks about ADHD, when you close your eyes and you think ADHD, you imagine this child, this hyperactive kid who doesn't sit still in the classroom. Maybe you think about that adult who's fidgety, who's impulsive, always doing something different, legs bouncing, as my leg was bouncing. That's what we think of when we think of ADHD, and that's how we got there. It all began with that idea of an encephalopathy, encephalitis, all those years ago, and here we are today, recognizing that it's not necessarily an encephalitis that causes it, but there are biological causes that result in the disorder.
Right. There must be some underlying biological mechanism to explain these symptoms. I mean, we know that certain underlying brain problems can create these symptoms. So if we see these symptoms, the assumption's made that the brain is doing something. It may not be a structural abnormality, but there's some functional abnormality that's creating these symptoms.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Let's shift now to what are some of the causes of ADHD. And
let me add one more thing. True ADHD is considered a neurodevelopmental disorder.
Right.
That it's present probably from birth.
Right.
And it is neurodevelopmental in origin.
Right.
Where I think you're headed now is there is this distinction between the neurodevelopmental disorder known as ADHD and another group of children who have the symptoms but who may not have the neurodevelopmental disorder.
Right.
Okay.
That is the path
that
we're
on. That's the distinction.
Yes.
Okay.
Because I remember working with a psychiatrist early in my training, and And whenever he would do an ADHD evaluation, one of the things that he would ask the parent is he would even ask the parent about the child's movement in utero. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to hear that a lot of parents who have kids with ADHD and who may have another child that doesn't have ADHD, they differentiate that. And they say, yeah, this kid moved a lot more, even in utero.
During the pregnancy.
During the pregnancy.
Okay.
So it is definitely a neurobehavioral disorder that comes from the brain. I mean, mm-hmm. that's...
Somehow the brain is involved.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Now, what tends to be... Because we don't have to rely on a diagnosis of encephalitis anymore, we can,
right.
and we don't have to wait until a person dies to perform an autopsy and look at the gross anatomy. Now we can look at neuroimaging. And what neuroimaging tells us is that kids with true ADHD do have brains that are slightly different than people who don't have ADHD.
Right.
Now, their brain isn't damaged, per se. It just functions different. And where that difference primarily lies is in the region we call the prefrontal cortex. So if you want to think about where that is, if you think about where your ear, the top of your ear meets your head, so that little fold right there, from that point forward, for the most part, it is your prefrontal cortex. So it's a large area of your brain, sort of geographically, mm-hmm. but when we think about what we're actually talking about with the prefrontal cortex, is we're only talking about the wrinkly part of your brain. So just that top layer, which is only, you know, a quarter of an inch or so thick, mm-hmm. it's very thin, and it just covers some underlying structures. But the way that our brain develops is it sort of starts from bottom to top. So it starts the brainstem, because that's the most important part to develop first, because we have to breathe and we have to make sure that our heart keeps beating and all those biological functions that keep us alive. That all starts at the brainstem, and development sort of grows from there. So if you think about that growth rate expanding out from the brainstem, mm-hmm. the last place that it's going to reach is that prefrontal cortex, that thin layer mm-hmm. of cortex at the front region of the brain. Now, what that area of our brain does is it manages, it's our executive assistant. And so we refer to those as executive functions. Those are the functions that keep us on calendar, that it keeps us organized, it keeps us in self-control, it makes sure that we aren't impulsive, it regulates all the underlying emotional parts of our life to make sure that we behave appropriately. All of that is housed up there. And we know from research that region of our brain isn't fully developed, even in healthy individuals, until our early to mid-20s. And for some with ADHD, it's even later than that if it does ever fully develop. So we're talking about a system now that we can see under functional MRI and CAT scans and PET scans, we can see that there are some functional differences in people with ADHD in this prefrontal cortex that isn't a problem in people who don't have ADHD.
Right.
It's a consistent finding that we see. It's not diagnostic because people can have poor functioning up there for a variety of reasons. People with schizophrenia, for example, also have poor functioning up in that region. But it is a consistent finding that we see in individuals with ADHD. So it creates a lot of problems in self-monitoring, working memory, a lot of executive function systems. And we're going to talk about that more probably in the next podcast, because we're already over 35 minutes. And so we're not going to get into some of the stuff that we want to talk about as far as diagnostically what we do to identify ADHD. But there are certainly some biological consequences or biological causes for ADHD that we know. We also know that there's probably a genetic component. Most people with ADHD, if I sit down with a kid that I think has ADHD, all I need to do is meet one of their parents. Richard, you met my mom.
I did.
She's
yes.
She's a pretty
yes.
hyperactive,
yes.
impulsive person. And you've met my brother, who was also very hyperactive, very impulsive, mm-hmm. Very inattentive. So it is something that runs in families.
It does run in families, yes. Now, we don't say it's inherited, but we say it's familial.
Right.
It tends to run in families.
Right.
And it tends to come from fathers
right.
down.
You know, right.
More typically. Because males are overrepresented.
Right.
Generally.
Right.
It tends to go. But certainly it's not confined only to males.
Correct.
Right.
And we're learning more that ADHD is present in girls just as often.
Right.
Maybe just as often. But the topography of the symptoms are different.
Symptoms are different. Yeah, the
right.
morphology, the appearance of the symptoms differ.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we would call that the phenotype mm-hmm. Of the disorder is different in girls than it is in boys.
Right.
So we know that there's this heritability, this mm-hmm. familial aspect of ADHD.
Right.
We know that it's biological. But Dr. Richard, one of the things you and I talked about, and we wanted to make sure that we mentioned this, because we talk about, you know, how there's lots of people who claim that in the past we didn't have this mm-hmm. problem with ADHD and everything. There also is an environmental aspect of ADHD.
Oh, yes.
And we were talking about it the other day, and Dr. Richard told me this interesting story about his Sunday afternoon. Tell me about your Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon. I grew up, it was an Italian family. And for those of you who know about Italian families, you know that noon on Sunday is a big spaghetti dinner that your grandmother made. And when my grandfather sat at the table, the rest of the family sat at the table. He sat at the head, and I sat on his left side, and my brother sat on his right side. And that's where we learned inhibition. You stayed at the table, you did what you were told, you behaved yourself, and you didn't get up until he was finished and he got up. You didn't sit until he sat and didn't get up until he got up. And that's one of the places where we learned how to inhibit our movement. We simply weren't allowed to act crazy and move a lot when we were around him. Church was another place we learned movement. There was no children's church in those years. You went to church with your parents and you sat between them or next to one of them within pinching distance. And you learn how to inhibit during that 1 or 1.5 hour service.
Right.
Mealtimes, 5 o'clock dinner hour, you know, it was another place where we had to come in and sit. No TV, no cell phone. And you were just expected not to act out and not to be too silly and too crazy. So we had many opportunities when I was growing up. I had many opportunities to learn how to inhibit my impulses.
Right.
My children didn't have as many opportunities. And I often wonder if they had had the same opportunities, would they have more inhibition today?
Right. And so we have these biological systems at play.
Right.
And you know, we always like to have the discussion of nature versus nurture in our field. And this is certainly one of those situations where the overlap of nature and nurture has a role. It has an impact. And, you know, when we think about life in the 50s and 60s, it started changing as we got into the 70s and really changing in the 80s. What we see is that the family system began to change. There was more consistency in the 1950s,
right.
in the 1940s and all. There was more, there were more, there was more predictability in a kid's life. The
right.
fact that you are your age and you can remember as a child that you sat on the left side and he sat on the right side and this
right.
is what happened. That suggests that that was a very impressionable experience and that it was consistent and it happened routinely
right.
over and over and over again.
Every Sunday.
Every Sunday.
I knew where I was going to be at noon on Sunday. I knew we were going to church at 8 o'clock. I knew where I was going to be at noon. I knew that I had to be at my dinner table every night at 5 o'clock. Didn't matter what else I was doing.
Right.
I was at the table at 5 o'clock. You know, that predictability doesn't exist today.
Right. Yeah. And so what has happened over time is that as the family system has changed,
right.
so has the environment in which these kids are growing up.
Right.
So I we're saying this, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it as we go, but I want you to think about, as we're talking about this, what this does to the prevalency rates of the disorder, how this might be related to the number of diagnoses that are being made. Now, I have a couple of issues with the number of diagnoses being made, and we're going to talk about that. But for right now, let's focus on the fact that when the family system changes and the environment has made the modifications that it has made over the past few decades, there is definitely a change in behavior. There's definitely a change in the way in which a disorder is going to present. Mm-hmm. And there's also a change in the way in which kids behave in general, whether they have a disorder or not.
Right.
So what has happened over the past couple of decades, of course, now we have both parents working. We have a significant increase in single parent homes, which single parents often do a fantastic job. But what that means is that there's less consistency, tends to be less consistency,
mm-hmm.
because that single parent is working. That single parent may not get home from work until 5:30 or 6 o'clock, which means that a child is often either in a after-school care or doing something else between the time of school getting out and the time the parent gets home. Parents often get home tired, and so they don't have the time to fix mm-hmm. a home-cooked meal for everybody to sit around the table. And
mm-hmm.
so that system is changing. We also know that we have more mixed families, blended families.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a difference because now you have a situation where we have one routine at dad's house, we have another routine at mom's house, and that throws kids off. So our entire culture really is different, has changed over the past few decades, which results in behavioral changes in children. Now, do we think that these environmental changes causes more ADHD? No, absolutely not. Now, the prevalency rate is certainly increasing. Dr. Richard has some statistics on what the rates are, and we're going to point out a few specific things with these rates because I think it's an important stimulation for this conversation.
Let me pause there a minute. So when you're saying rates are increasing, and you're talking about the effect of nurture.
Right.
We have a neurodevelopmental disorder that occurs in a certain percentage of children.
Correct.
But what you're saying is culture has also changed, and those cultural changes, changes to family, family life, family dynamics, family constitution, those changes are affecting the rate of ADHD or the diagnosis of ADHD?
The diagnosis of ADHD.
So the number of children with true ADHD may not be increasing.
Right.
But the number who show the symptoms of ADHD may be increasing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. So again, we're talking about that. Is it a neurodevelopmental disorder or is it just symptoms?
Right.
So I may not have had true ADHD when I was growing up, but because I was in this highly structured environment, the symptoms were kept at a minimum.
Right.
Okay, so right. I really didn't have the disorder. Or I may have had the disorder. Well, I think the important thing is the symptoms weren't able to appear as readily because I lived in a more structured environment.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
So let's think about, if you follow our blog or follow us on Facebook, you saw earlier this week we posted an article about ADHD, comparing ADHD in the United States and ADHD in France. And what was impressive about that article is that it talked about the fact that ADHD is far less diagnosed. There's far fewer diagnoses of ADHD in France than there is in the United States. And what the article did a really nice job of doing is delineating some differences between parenting styles and some of these environmental things that we're talking about, some of the differences between France and the United States. That should make us think. And the reason that should make us think is, biologically, French people are no different than people from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
People from Germany are no different biologically from people in England or anywhere else. Why would the prevalency rates be different?
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we have to put some onus on the environment. So, Dr. Richard, share with us some of those statistics that you found there in the ADHD explosion text that I was referring to earlier.
Right. Yeah. What we're always concerned about is are there differences? Do we produce more children with ADHD? Does it occur at higher rates? And there was a study done, part of CDC, called the National Survey of Child's Health. And in 2003, the rate was 7.8%. 7.8% of American children had a diagnosis. By 2007, it was 9.5%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a 22% increase, which is fairly significant. And by 2012, the rate was 11%. So we've gone from 7.8 to 9.5 to 11% of the population.
In 9 years.
In 9 years. And the 7.8, that means 1 in 30 children. But 9.5 is 1 in 9 children. 6.4 million children. If 1 in 9 have it, it's about 6 or 7 million children. The overall rate for males, because 11% have it, but males are overrepresented. So the overall rate for males is 15%. And the overall rate for high school students, for males in high school, is almost 20%. So that's one in five. 1 in 5.
It's amazing.
Males of high school age have been
in the United States
with ADHD. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. To consider, to think, 1 in 5.
1 in 5.
Now, mm-hmm. if that was anything else,
it would be an intolerable epidemic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, now, to just emphasize this a little bit more, what we know from some of the research is that there's regional differences.
And that's the most troublesome part of this, is that when the nice thing about this study is that it broke down categories, number one, across time. And so we see a gradual increase in the number of diagnoses that were made. And I should add that by 2011, there wasn't enough stimulant medication made for all the people who had the disorder.
Right.
There was a big controversy, a big issue about that in 2011, 2012, that for the first time, the demand for the medication outstripped the supply of the medication. So we see an increase. But the other interesting part about this study is that it also looked at regional differences. And to me, that's the most troublesome part of this, the increase in the diagnosis and the fact that though there are students, there are children who have a neurodevelopmental disorder, we need to be very, very careful because the regional differences show us that the diagnosis of ADHD is made far more frequently in the South and the Midwest than it is in the Western states or the New England states. And that probably reflects regional differences in how children are expected to act.
Right.
For example, in 2007, the rate of ADHD in North Carolina was 16%.
Now, just to remember,
right,
the national rate
was less than 10.
Was less than 10 in 2007.
9.5%. But in North Carolina, it was 16%. And even more alarming is that for boys above the age of 9, the rate was 30%. So again, we're talking about 9.5%. But if you were a 9-year-old or older boy in North Carolina, the rate was 30%.
1 in 3.
So obviously there's some difference between how boys were expected to act and how they were acting.
Right.
Because 30% is astronomically high. I mean, and so we see these regional differences. And what a regional difference like that says to me as a psychologist and as a parent is that something else is going on. Something else is at work here.
Right.
That we're 30% of children don't have a neurodevelopmental disorder called ADHD.
Right.
Something else is at work. And the something else, I think, is expectation.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so,
is that what the France article said?
Yes.
There's lower rates.
Right.
But
what it focused on was the expectations of the parents and how the parents managed the children. Okay. And I really want to highlight, Richard, what you just said, and that is, or in what you said a moment ago, to tie it together, 1 in 3 boys over the age of 9 in 2007 was diagnosed with ADHD. Do we think that 1 in 3 kids over the age of 9 in North Carolina really had ADHD?
No.
And so this is where I think people begin to have problems with psychology as a field.
Right.
Because what we do in psychology is we make diagnoses based upon behavioral presentations. If a person reports symptoms of depression, we do some assessments and stuff, and we say, okay, that person has depression. there's no biological diagnostic tool that we can use to say, right, yes, this is confirmatory, this person has ADHD. So we look at a cluster of symptoms and we look at the behavioral presentation, which relies on the reports from the parents, mm-hmm, relies on reports from the teacher, and relies on reports from the child, him or herself. When our expectations, or when we create a system in the environment that has expectations on children that they're not able to meet for whatever reason, then we're going to see them as disordered. And then we make the diagnosis of ADHD. Let's use school as an example. We've talked about this multiple times before, but we'll use it as an example as it relates to ADHD. There are schools in our community that expects kindergartners to read. Mm-hmm. Not just read, but to read and then write a book report, mm-hmm, on what they read. As a developmental expert, that is developmentally inappropriate. That expectation far exceeds what is developmentally expected from a 5 or 6 year old child. When a child that's 5 or 6 years old is expected to do that, but then they're unable to do that, they may still be developmentally appropriate. They just can't meet that expectation because the expectation is so high, they are seen as disordered. If they're doing that and they're not sitting in their seat, if the teacher sees the child as understanding what she's asking him or her to do, but the child is then refusing to do it, they may be seen as oppositional or they may be seen as inattentive, and that's going to lead to our diagnosis of ADHD. Mm-hmm. That child may not have ADHD. It may just be that the expectations of the environment exceed what the child can do developmentally. Mm-hmm. But the child may still be developmentally appropriate. And as we, what the problem that we're having and how this sort of ties to the educational stuff we've been talking about over the past few weeks is, as our expectations academically continue to increase, we're going to have more and more children who are unable to meet those expectations. And when they're unable to meet those expectations, what do you do when you're sitting in a classroom and you can't follow what the teacher's talking about or you can't meet those expectations? Mm-hmm. You're off task. You're not paying attention. You make careless mistakes. You get out of your seat. You get become fidgety. Mm-hmm. And you look like you have ADHD.
You look like... Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah. What happens then is the teacher says something to the parent. The parent then says, oh, you know, you're right. They're not doing their homework. They're not doing the things here at home that they're supposed to be doing to prepare for school. Again, because the schoolwork is developmentally appropriate, they go to a doctor. They tell them those symptoms. And certainly from the doctor's perspective, that sounds like ADHD. Few physicians are capable of recognizing the developmental appropriateness of a curriculum, academic curriculum. Now, that's something that Dr. Richard and I do every day. When we see patients, one of the things that we talk to them about is, what is the curriculum asking of that person, and is that developmentally appropriate for where that child is?
Right. We've mentioned a couple of times about what's happened with kindergarten, for example.
Right.
That when we were in school, what we were expected to do in first grade, our children are expected to do in kindergarten. So when we developed this standards-based curriculum, somebody had the brilliant idea to say, well, let's start reading in kindergarten. Let's push five-year-olds to read. Let's push five-year-olds to write, because that's what they're doing in other countries. The expectation is wrong.
Right.
Okay? But your child is in a kindergarten. The teacher tells the parent, your child is not keeping up. There must be something wrong with my child.
Right.
So I go to a healthcare provider, or I go to a psychologist, say, what's wrong with my child? When in fact, there may not be anything wrong with your child. It may be that the curriculum your child is expected to master is not appropriate.
Right.
When I went to school, we had recess in the morning, recess after lunch, and recess in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. When my children went to school, we were told, we don't have time for play anymore.
Right.
We have, reading is too important, math is too important. We don't have time for recess, for PE, for music. We have these academic subjects that we have to do. So my children never had the advantage of having a recess in school. Well, and they were expected to be able to sit and concentrate for 4 hours at a time, which I think is developmentally inappropriate. I don't think kids are built that way.
And even lunch nowadays,
right,
is silent lunch.
Silent lunch.
You're not allowed to talk at lunch. Mm-hmm. So we're creating an environment that fosters symptoms that we often associate with ADHD. Mm-hmm. But again, to be clear, we're not making more ADHD.
Right.
We are creating environments that result in behaviors that we associate with ADHD.
Kids display the symptoms of inattention because they're not interested.
Right.
Because it's above their level.
Yeah. I mean, I do this with my graduate students. When I'm teaching ADHD, I'll pull out a genetics book, a book that I don't understand either, right. But I'll start reading from the genetics book, and it will just take less than half a page before they're looking off to somewhere
else.
They're
all drifting away.
Because that is not their, they don't understand that because that's not right. their area of expertise, not because they're not smart,
right.
not because they don't, they're not worthy of being in graduate
students.
School.
Right.
It's because the material is beyond them.
Right.
So, you know, we have to consider that part of the prevalency explosion that we're seeing with ADHD is at least in part a result of what we're doing in the environment, both at school and at home. Again, with the non-traditional homes that we often have now,
right.
You know, the sad fact is that a lot of parents are less consistent now than they used to be. You know, I had a lot of predictability in my life. I knew about what time my mom was going to be home from work. I knew what time my dad was going to come home from work.
Right.
I knew that because every day it happened, my dad would get home from work and he would sit down in his chair
right.
and he would turn on the TV, smoke a cigarette and drink some sweet tea and yell at us to go outside.
Right. Get out of
here so I can relax. But that predictability creates right. some comfort for the child so that they are able to develop and they're able to gain some self-regulation. Today, we don't have that as much, and that certainly elicits a lot of these behaviors.
So you have the predictability factor, that's one thing. Then you have inappropriate expectations.
Right.
That's another thing, that we're asking kids to do things that they're simply not, especially boys,
right.
I might add, that they're not developmentally able to do.
Right.
So we have unpredictability, lack of structure, lack of opportunity to learn inhibition, because now many families eat dinner not and have conversation. They have cell phones and TVs
right.
and other devices. So we're on the one hand, we're taking away the things that help us to learn how to inhibit.
Right.
While at the same time, we have unrealistic expectations of some of these school kids.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So it's a combination of all of this. And again, it's creating ADHD-like symptoms in kids who may otherwise have full capacity to right. regulate themselves and to self-monitor and to engage right. in appropriate behaviors. All right. Now, as I'm looking at the time, we're at an hour.
Okay.
So we're going to wrap up here for this week. Man, we're not even halfway through my agenda.
I didn't think we did.
I didn't mention it, but I did have another agenda for this week. Just to help out as we're going through and keep us on task and focused.
Okay.
But as you can tell, this is a topic that we really like to talk about, and I think is really important for us to discuss. So we're gonna end this week here. Next week, what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk a little bit more about some issues that we think are related to the prevalency rates, especially nutrition.
And yeah, we haven't even talked about that. Environmental toxins and nutrition, which, like expectations and impulse control, are also contributing factors
absolutely.
To the exploding rates of ADHD.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the issue with sugar and, mm-hmm. and caffeine and those kinds of things. And then we're going to get into, all right, so now we have this situation. What do we do about it? What are some of the treatments associated with ADHD? And how do we correct some of these problems that we have created? Sound good?
Sounds good to me. Yep.
Okay.
Let's get started.
So again, we appreciate you listening. Mentioned it before, but you know, you can follow us on Facebook, on our blog at thementalbreakdown.com, on Twitter Dr. Bernie at DRBERNEY. If you haven't already, you can check us out on iTunes. We'd love for you to leave a review and comments. That certainly helps boost our status so that other people can know that we're there. It's a little bit difficult to find us because we're pretty new. So definitely do that. And send us in your ideas, your thoughts, your anecdotes, and we'd be happy to include them as we're doing our podcast, because they will certainly help other people. Whatever helps you is certainly very likely to help a whole bunch of other people as well. So with that said, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.